that is one thing that really keeps me going in this business, is that anything can happen and you can have the most amazing, unexpected experiences with little to no warning.
I'm Lee Foster. You're listening to Action, the No Bullshit podcast dedicated to the pursuit of acting excellence. Enjoy this episode.
All right, Chris Agos, thanks for coming back.
Well, thanks for having me back. This is an honor to be with you.
So you've been on a couple of episodes in the past, but why don't you just reintroduce yourself to people who haven't heard those episodes?
Sure. So my name's Chris Agos. I'm originally from Chicago, was born in the area, and started doing voiceover in 1995 when I was still in college at DePaul. And that kind of led to me exploring on-camera stuff and finding out more about the work that was available in the Chicago market. So one thing led to another, and I took class after class after class, and eventually just kind of carved out a career for myself that lasted about 22 years or so as a Chicago-based voice talent and actor. I did all the bread and butter stuff that's available in the Midwest, the commercials and the industrials, the print and the VO and so on and so forth. And at some point I started doing TV when that work became available in Chicago. And eventually did enough work and taught enough that I wrote a book called Acting in Chicago, which we're in our third edition now, and it's sort of the go-to guide for people who are wanting to make a living as an actor, as a Midwest-based actor. Then at some point, my family and I decided that we were going to make a change. And so we moved to Los Angeles about 4 years ago. It was hard to give up Chicago, but there are all kinds of reasons for that. And I'm sure if you're interested, I can tell you more about that. But we moved to LA. And so these days I do some voiceover, some commercials, but really my thrust is trying to do more TV and features. So there was a big transition a few years ago, and that's what I do now. When it comes to voiceover, I try to stay busy, and I've written another book called The Voiceover Startup Guide, which is designed as a quick sort of VO 101. For folks who are interested in that business but don't really know where to start. So that's what I'm up to these days.
And just a few of your credits, many, many episodes on Chicago Fire and Chicago PD, Grey's Anatomy, House of Cards. You are you play Buzz Aldrin in the new Apple show, For All Mankind. We're going to talk a lot about that. I first want to talk to you about the move to LA and how that's gone, because I'm really interested in that. So you said you moved 4 years ago. Why did you decide to move?
It's kind of a long story, I think, as any big transitions have like a big story behind them. I'll try to make it simple. There are really two things that that sort of pushed us in that direction. There was the career and the life circumstance. The career thing, I think, is probably most important in this, you know, for what we're talking about. So in Chicago, as you know, because you're there, it's a smaller market. It's not New York or Los Angeles. So there isn't enough of one particular type of work to keep you busy. Like, you can't say, I'm just going to be a commercial guy. You kind of have to do everything. You do corporate stuff. You do VO commercials. And a lot of people do improv and theater at the same time. And but because it is a small market, there is sort of a cap on the amount of progress you can make. And I say that knowing that everybody's version of progress is different. And for me, after working there for 20 plus years, I felt like I had hit a ceiling. I felt like I had done all of the TV shows that were there at the time. And once you do one of those shows, you're kind of done. Like, they can't use you again, unless you're a series regular. And it was incredibly rare for a Chicago-based actor to be cast as a series regular. So I didn't see that as a realistic possibility. And in terms of features, you know, some features would come through and spend a couple of weeks here and there, but a lot of times they would import their cast, and the the local actors would get smaller roles. So my goal eventually, as I kind of went through all of the work that was available, my goal became to become a series regular on a show. And it was a long time in coming, but I think what I realized was that, you know, it's one thing to be where the work is at, but it's another thing to be where the casting is at. And it became clear to me that in my demographic and my age, because by the time I realized this, I'm in my 40s, you know, I was not new to the business and I was getting on in years. I was literally running out of marketable time. And I thought, you know, if that's ever going to happen for me, I think my best shot at it is going to be in LA. So like so many other actors, you know, we picked up and moved. The personal side of things was the timing just kind of worked out because my wife and I had a set of twin boys. And when we got pregnant with them and when they were infants, we really needed to be in Chicago in order to kind of have the family support system. But then when they reached a point where they were going to go to kindergarten, we had this big decision, like, we were in the city, we were living in the city, and our local school was not really an option for us. So we were looking at, do we move to the suburbs or do we just go ahead and rip the Band-Aid off and do this thing we'd been talking about for, you know, however many years, move to LA. And we decided that it was worth the risk to move to LA. So that's what we did.
And how has it been in LA compared to what your expectations were?
I think it's been LA has met my expectations. In other words, before I got here, I came and did sort of a pilot program, which not everybody can do, but we were very lucky in the sense that I literally took 3 months off of being a Chicago-based actor and rented a room with a friend here. I took a bedroom in his apartment for 3 months. And I just wanted to be in the market, meeting with agents, trying to get a feel for the place, just to try to, you know, kind of try to understand if I would like it here, because I had visited, but I had never really spent much time here. So I had no expectations for that particular trip. I thought I would literally, you know, take some classes and try to meet some people and maybe hook up with an agent and that's it. And that's more or less what happened, except I lucked into a huge voiceover job that lasted for like a year and a half and financed our move and gave us a big financial cushion and everything. And there was this big monster job that came out of nowhere in LA while I was there, like literally 2 weeks before I was supposed to move back home. So that was sort of like a little light bulb, like, oh, there's work to be had here. It's just, it's not like in Chicago where, for me, work came all the time. And part of that was because I'd been in the market for so long and everybody knew me and everyone knew what I did well. And when that came up, I was, you know, on the short list for that. Same thing happens in LA, but because I didn't know anyone, I expected that I would have no work. And that's pretty much what happened until this very lucky thing happened. So when I moved, I expected it to be very quiet and to have boots on the ground and take a long time developing relationships and getting in the room and all of that stuff. And that's pretty much what has happened. Do I wish that my progress was faster? Well, yeah. You know, I think everybody wishes that, unless you get extraordinarily lucky out of the gate. I've done pretty well. Like, if we're talking about results, I've landed on some shows that were bucket list shows, and that's cool. But I still have so much more to do and so many more people to meet. And I think that is a huge difference between Chicago and LA. The size and scope of the business is just so much larger out here that you just need to put in more time. So that's what I'm doing. And that's what most people come out here wind up realizing, that, you know, in order to make progress, you just have to put in the time.
Man, I have so many questions. you know, a lot of people ask me if they should move to Chicago as like a stepping stone to LA. Let's say, like, I know a lot of people who live in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and they think that it makes a lot of sense to move to Chicago or like Atlanta or something in order to get some credits and then go to New York or LA. And I always give the same advice, and I don't know if it's the right thing to tell them, but I always tell them, you're going to have to put in a lot of time wherever you go. So if you go to Chicago, it's going to take you a while to meet all the casting directors, get their trust, get to know everybody, and then start auditioning, and then hopefully you book work. And then if you do that, then you build up the credits. That takes a while. And then if you move to LA, you're going to have to do the same thing again. You're going to have to start over.
That's 100% true. Yeah.
Right. So I usually tell people, if you're going to move, move to LA. Just go there and start putting in the work there. Does that make sense?
It does. And I remember when I started in Chicago in 1995, I was at DePaul, and I remember thinking, like 6 months in, when I had nothing going on and I didn't know anybody, I remember thinking, man, if I had just gotten started when I was like 18 or 17, I would have, you know, however many years, I'd have, you know, 4 years under my belt by now. And when we moved to LA, I said, man, can you imagine what it'd be like right now if we'd moved here 10 years ago? I'd have all the work I ever needed. So it's true that it doesn't matter where you land. You're going to have to put in the time, meet the people, and do the thing. And if it, I would say to those folks from Minneapolis or Nashville or wherever they're coming from, I would say that it really depends on what you want. You don't necessarily go to Los Angeles if you want to work on Broadway, right? Like, that's not probably the best spot for you. If your goal is not necessarily to become the next big shot movie star or, you know, big time series regular, I think Atlanta's great, just like I think Chicago's great. But I think there is also this perception, real or not, true or not, that the series regs generally come from LA or New York or London, or in these days, Australia. Like, they're getting actors from everywhere. And there is a perception that if you're really, really good, you're really solid, then that's where you're going to be. And again, true or not, I think that most of the casting directors that cast the projects that are super visible, you know, the big superhero movies and the big time TV shows, those are LA-based casting directors. And when they go searching for their cast, they start in that market. Now, plenty of them, I'm sure, will accept tape from, you know, anywhere. But I think at the end of the day, if you have to, they're going to want to meet you. And the days of being flown in for a test from Toronto or New York or whatever, that doesn't happen nearly as often as it used to, you know. So I don't know. I do think that depending on what it is that you want, you do have to be where the casting is, because it's just a logistical thing. Now, there are exceptions to everything, right? Like Dacre Montgomery sent in a self-tape and wound up being like a huge deal on Stranger Things. And I think that guy is probably good for a while. Like, that was the kind of job that levels you up. And that happened off a self-tape. Great for him. That happens. But if we're talking about taking steps to put yourself in the best possible position to land as a series reg, I still kind of have to believe that, you know, you have to be where the casting is.
I've said this before on the podcast, and I don't know if I've told you, but I was under the impression when I moved to Chicago that there were much less opportunities than LA or New York, but there were opportunities for TV and film, and that if you got the audition, you were in the same pool as everybody else who got the audition. Mm-hmm. And I had a big come to reality moment when I was on Chicago Fire. I got a recurring role on that. And I had multiple people who really knew what they were talking about. My agents, my acting coach, tell me that they were going to try to book this out of LA or New York. And that's just the way it goes. Yeah. And I was kind of like, well, why? I mean, I got the audition. I got the callback. I got put on hold. I'm in the same pool as everybody else. And when I ended up booking it, the director pulled me aside and he was like, I had to fight for you so hard. Like, the network was basically demanding that I book it out of New York or LA.
And I think that goes back to that perception. And again, real or not, the perception is that, you know, if you're a working professional, you know, you work in LA and New York. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, there are great actors that are all over the country, in fact, all over the world, right? We've seen that over and over. I just feel like that sentiment is pretty entrenched. And you know, that goes to this whole idea of like, well, if I have credits that are not LA based credits, do they count? And that's, I think, yes, they do. But I also think that they count differently. Because they count in the sense that, you know, casting can see that, yes, you've got some screen time, you've got some experience on set, you're not going to embarrass anybody, or hold anything up because other people have trusted you. But, you know, if you're looking at an actor with, you know, five local market credits, co-star credits versus five LA credits, I think, I can't speak for anybody, but I do think that LA-based credits do tend to speak a little bit louder in terms of credibility. When I was in Chicago, I always thought it was always about credibility. It was like, you know, back when I was around, it seemed pretty clear that, you know, the larger guest stars and the series regs always came from outside the market, and the co-stars and the smaller, you know, guest stars would come from Chicago. I don't know if that's exactly still the case, because I mean, by now, like the Dick Wolf shows have probably gone through everybody that are available. But it is a sort of a subconscious credibility thing that I think still exists. Now, that's not to say like that you shouldn't, you know, there are plenty of people who work in Chicago, stay in Chicago, live there, are totally happy there, and, you know, are creatively fulfilled there. Chicago's awesome. Atlanta's awesome. It just, again, goes back to what is it that you want? What's your goal? If your goal is to, you know, definitely wind up as a regular or someone who's actually leading a show, well, nobody does that alone. You need power players in the industry to help you get to that spot. And those power players are on the coasts. They're generally not in Chicago. So that's another part of the equation, the relationship part.
Yeah. I'm not going to say the name of the agent that we shared, but do you have the same agent that you had when you were here?
I do not.
Okay. Do you have an agent out there, or do you only have a manager?
So I have a manager. I was actually agentless since last April, and it's January of 2020 right now. So I went 6-8 months without an agent, and I just agreed to sign with an agency last week.
Wow. Okay. So I have a listener question from Nelson Rithaller, who's a longtime listener of the show. He's been on some episodes, and he is in LA. He moved there, 2 years ago or something like that. He wanted me to ask you about what's the deal with having a manager versus an agent? How does that work? And he wanted me to ask, does it benefit a young, like a newer actor to have a manager out in LA?
Mm-hmm. Well, the short answer is yes. I think generally there's a benefit to having both an agent and a manager. When you're developmental, and you don't have a whole ton of credits, a manager basically acts as a second agent in the sense that they are also submitting you on the breakdowns in addition to your talent agency. At least that's kind of how it's supposed to work. But the individual manager makes a huge difference. You can find a manager who works really hard for you, but there are also managers who don't. So you have to be pretty careful about who you decide to align yourself with. In general, talent agents, something I learned, which I didn't know before I moved here, talent agents are the only entity in that whole process that are actually, by state law, allowed to negotiate your deal when you get a booking. So a manager technically is not supposed to negotiate any kind of part of your fee or anything. So if you just have a manager, typically what people will do is if they get a booking that the manager secured for them, they'll have an entertainment lawyer actually do the negotiating of the deal. And a lot of times lawyers will charge 5% versus the agent's 10%. So it works out. But yeah, I actually didn't know that they play different roles at all levels of, you know, all tiers of the industry. But managers are not supposed to negotiate on your behalf. So that's, I think, the first and probably main difference between the two. But eventually you want your manager, you want to be in a position where your manager does more than just act as a second agent, in the sense that they take a wider, longer term, broader view of your career and try to, guide it in a way that makes sense. So today that might mean, you know, let's say you're someone who is a series reg on a show, that is kind of a smaller, you know, show that doesn't have a huge audience. So your manager would probably try to find ways to just make you more visible. So he might align you with some brands. He might hook you up with some people that might try to boost, you know, your social media presence, try to introduce you to some, maybe some directors or writers that may help you get your next job, and so on and so forth. Agents, I've discovered out here, in general, again, this is all general, don't really do that kind of stuff. They're submitting you, and they're trying to keep you out there in front of casting and busy and working. But the bigger picture stuff is either left to you or to your manager. Now, if you ask them for their opinion, like, hey, this is kind of where I want to go in 3 or 5 years, how do I get there? They'll tell you. But they're much more focused, I think, on the day-to-day and just getting you to that next paycheck. So for me, in my situation, I did come out here with agency representation. That did not work out. I made a change into a different agent. Those folks were very nice, but I didn't feel like that was the right place for me. So I chose not to renew. So that was a huge gamble. And then when 2019 kind of came and went and I was still agentless, I noticed it for sure. I still had my manager and he was submitting, but the volume of auditions that I had dropped pretty dramatically. It's always been better for me personally to have both an agent and a manager pitching and doubling up on pitches. Because I'm in that weird position where I'm like not a new actor, certainly, but I'm also not, I haven't been in LA long enough for everybody to know me. People still have to be convinced sometimes to bring me in. That's kind of where I'm at. And for the foreseeable future, until something changes, I'll still be at that point.
It's one thing I wonder about a lot. I've never worked in LA. I've never attempted to work in LA. I've never attempted to get an audition in LA, nothing. And in Chicago, as you know, there's like 4 or 5 casting directors. In LA, I have no idea how many casting directors there are, but you've been out there 4 years. Have you been to most of them? Have you met most of them now?
Oh my gosh, I wish.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I don't think I've been to even 10% of them, honestly. I hear numbers like 600-700.
Holy.
I mean, and I don't know, like, I don't know if that includes the casting director and the casting associates or what. I'm not sure really where that number comes from, that, but that's what gets tossed around a lot. And, you know, I've maybe been to 20 offices and, you know, a lot of these offices will handle multiple shows. So I'll go to the same place a couple of times for different shows. So I don't think my experience is really that unusual. But yeah, I mean, I have no illusions. I'm never going to meet all these people. Like, I just can't. And I don't think you should try, because I think that's part of your job is to research, you know, what your bullseye is, where you really want to be, and try to get in front of the folks who are in charge of casting those bullseye shows or those, you know, bullseye directors you want to work with. Because one thing that can be really valuable is the fact that people, you know, filmmakers and showrunners, they have teams. And when they find people that they really click with, they tend to continue to work with them. That's in front of the camera and behind. So that goes for casting. You know, if you know that you want to work on a Ryan Murphy show, you go find out who casts his shows, because he's got a ton of them. And there's a small team of people who are in charge of casting those things. That's on us, because we don't want to be spaghetti slingers. We don't want to just go out and like market to everyone and try to get in front of everyone, because it's just not realistic. It's too big. It's too many people. So if you're, the more information you have and the more targeted your efforts are, I think the faster your progress will be.
That's really good advice. Do you have other advice for people who are trying to establish themselves in LA? You've been out there for 4 years. You've booked some big shows, and you recently got this really big opportunity to play Buzz Aldrin on this big time show. What are some of the things that you think that you did right in establishing yourself, and what are things that you wish you had done sooner?
Well, I'll talk about the good stuff first, since you asked. I feel like my process for prep, for audition prep, has gotten much stronger in the past 4 years than it was when I first moved out here. And the reason is because it sort of has to be. I think I'm a more specific actor now than I was when I came here. And that's as a result of just wanting to feel like I'm much more prepared now whenever I'm, you know, putting myself out there than I used to be. You know, in Chicago, I don't want to say I was winging it, but I just didn't, you didn't have to work quite as hard. I didn't feel like I had to work quite as hard because, again, I was always being brought in for the same type of guy, the same type of thing. And so I could do that in my sleep, because that was my bread and butter. Here, it's not quite so cut and dried. So like it requires a little bit more flexibility. And that for me just meant much more detailed prep. So I think I do that better now than I used to. What I have not embraced and what I need to embrace is this whole idea of networking, because I hear the word networking and I automatically think schmoozing, and that makes me wrinkle my nose and I don't want to do it. But this is, it is a relationship business. People hire their friends and people who they are familiar with over and over again because it makes them comfortable. It's kind of human nature. Like, you're going to go with what you know, because that thing has not let you down in the past. So, I think everybody's got stories similar to this, but, you know, I'm not going to name the director or the actor or anything, but I have a friend who was up for a pretty good size role and a pretty good size feature that came out and did well. And it was down between, he was like, of all of the general casting that went on, he was the number one choice. He was like everybody's number one. And at one of the callbacks, you know, one of the producers kind of took him aside and said, "Hey, you know, this job is yours unless the director casts his friend." And who do you think ultimately booked the job?
Right.
You know, and so my buddy's like, "How do I get to be the director's friend?" You know, because that happens quite a bit. And you can kind of be bitter and angry about it. And you can be like, you know, nepotism and all of that. But the reality is that there are a lot of casting decisions that sort of fall into that category. They're influenced by, you know, the fact that a director or a producer worked with an actor before, or, you know, has a mutual friend, and that person sort of vouched for them. So what I haven't done at all is try to put any effort into kind of getting out there and just making myself available and getting to know people. So I need to do more of that. I think we all do, probably.
Mm-hmm. I'll take this this moment to recommend a book that's on Audible. I'm sure it's on paperback as well. It's called Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi. It's like the Bible of networking. It's great. It's great. I've listened to it a ton of times. And
great. Good recommendation. Thanks.
Yeah. Never Eat Alone. Keith Ferrazzi. Like, thank me later. I will. I'm going to take a quick pause to just talk about one of my affiliates, which is Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/actionpodcast, you can get a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial. You can download an audiobook. Go get Never Eat Alone. I suggest that. A couple others that I've listened to recently, The Art of Extraordinary Confidence by Dr. Aziz Ghazapura was great. How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. It's all about the new science of psychedelic research. Super interesting. And Essentialism by Greg McKeown. One of the best books I've ever read. And then you have both your books on Audible as well. I read the Acting in Chicago book, which like saved me years and years of time. So thankful that that book exists.
Super kind of you to say thanks.
Yeah. So those books are on Audible. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can get Acting in Chicago. We're in our third edition now, and that is available on Audible, as well as the Voiceover Startup Guide, How to Land Your First VO Job. The interesting thing about the VO book is that it actually comes with links to scripts. And if you get the print version, you get audio files. So you get scripts and you actually can kind of hear via the audio files what's being taught in the book. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah, sweet. Go get one of those for free. Audibletrial.com/action podcast. All right. So I want to talk about For All Mankind.
Yeah.
So it's an Apple show, the new Apple streaming service released a number of shows. One of them is this show, and you play Buzz Aldrin. So big opportunity. How did it happen?
Yeah, big opportunity. There were rumors for a while that Apple was getting into original content, and this job started off with just your everyday garden variety audition. The show did not have a name. Did not have a director when I auditioned. So all we had was a script. And of course, I didn't get to see the entire script, but they sent the sides, which consisted of a couple of scenes. And, you know, I just, the audition prep started with, of course, reading the sides and knowing sort of the provenance of the show. I knew that Ron Moore was behind it. He does Outlander on Stars. He's also the showrunner behind the reboot of Battlestar Galactica a couple of years ago. And I knew that, you know, these were shows that sci-fi fans were super passionate about. So I expected it to be good and, read the sides, and it was good. One of the scenes was, sort of your average audition scene in the sense that it was kind of relationshipy. Between Buzz and one of the other astronauts. But the other scene was the thing that was most interesting to me because it was the last minute and a half or so of the Apollo 11 moon landing flight. And our show, first of all, if you don't know anything about it, it's an alt history set in the late 1960s at NASA. And Ron wondered what would have happened if the Russians had landed on the moon first and the space race had never really ended. Because in reality, NASA, you know, did that amazing thing and then funding got pulled and put into the Vietnam War. And there were all kinds of other political decisions that were made that basically dramatically changed, you know, the program, the trajectory, pun intended, that NASA was on. We thought we were going to get moon bases in intergalactic travel, and we never got that. So he was wondering, what if we got that stuff? So the whole first season is spent sort of exploring that idea. So my scene that I had to do for the audition was the last moments of the Apollo 11 flight. And as I was reading it, all of it sounded so realistic that I wondered if they actually lifted the audio from the actual mission. So I went to YouTube and I pulled up the audio of that Apollo 11 moon landing flight. And sure enough, many, many things, you know, that were actually said on the flight made their way into the script. So right then that told me that what the writers were expecting to hear from these auditions needed to line up with what they had heard already as part of this audio. So if I just got close to that, if I just kind of put myself in that world, I would at least have a decent chance at booking this job because I was the right demographic to play Buzz. And I just had to show them that I kind of understood the whole astronaut thing, which is, you know, filled with a lot of acronyms and jargon and space talk and stuff that people don't say in real life. I just listened to that audio over and over and over again, and I read everything I could in a short amount of time because I think I had like maybe 24 hours or, you know, 2 days max to prep for this. I read everything I could about the moon landing and about Buzz, and went in there and did it. And of course, didn't hear anything for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And then out of nowhere, my manager calls me and he's like, "Hey, you're pinned for this For All Mankind thing," which was kind of shocking. But I, at the same time, I was like, I'll be darned, you know, you do the right kind of prep and it actually pays off, you know? So yeah, in the end, wound up shooting for about 6 months on that show. Buzz was written into the first two episodes, and beyond that, they didn't know if they were going to use Buzz. And I was lucky enough that they wrote him into six episodes later into the season. So he was around. His character was not really fleshed out because they really focused on the fictional characters, but he's definitely present throughout season one. So it was a great experience. It was one of the coolest things I've ever done.
So no callbacks.
No callback. No. I was surprised. In fact, I didn't meet Ron until the table read to the second episode. The pilot episode, I couldn't make the table read. I was actually shooting some commercials. So yeah, he wasn't on set for any of the pilot stuff. We shot the first two episodes sort of back to back together, as one thing. And I just, you know, he wasn't around on the days that I was there. So yeah, it took me a while to even meet him. Yeah. So it happens. I mean, it might as, you know, you hear about stuff getting booked off self-tape all the time. In our case, anyway, they don't really do callbacks for our show. At least they didn't for the season I was on.
So do you think that you were written into more episodes simply because they hadn't finished the storyline and that's just the way it worked? Or do you think it had something to do with you as a human being, you, Chris?
Well, of course, I want to think it was the second thing, that they loved me so much that they just had to have me back. I think it's a little mix of both. I think that, you know, they hadn't written all 10 episodes when they booked me. And what I know about our show is that, you know, it's set in a real time period with real circumstances, but a lot of it is fictionalized. And I think as they focused on those fictional story arcs, you know, they started off the season with a lot of real life characters being present on screen. And then the deeper they got into it, they really moved away from the real life guys. And I think they wanted to bring a little bit of that a little bit back, just to kind of remind people that, yes, these are events that actually took place, and to try to just kind of weave it back in. So I think that's probably why they chose to bring Buzz back. And also, it makes sense to bring Buzz in because he is still very much alive and he still makes the news once in a while, as opposed to, you know, there were three astronauts on that Apollo 11 flight, Neil Armstrong, you know, he's passed away. Michael Collins was the astronaut who did not make it down to the moon's surface. He stayed up orbiting the moon. And he's visible, but not nearly as visible as Buzz. So I think it made sense to bring Buzz back. And I also think the other part of it is that, you know, I showed up on time and I knew my stuff and I did the job and I wasn't a pain, you know. So I want to think that I made it easy for them to make that decision to bring me back. But I do feel like it was story motivated. It was not, you know, motivated to work with Chris Agos again.
Gotcha. So I'm really curious, what was it like to play not only a historic figure, but Buzz? I mean, it's Buzz Aldrin. Yeah. Like, yeah. We all know Buzz Aldrin.
I know there are schools named after him. It was at first kind of a whoa type of reaction, like, whoa, how am I going to do this? But the pressure was sort of lifted a little bit by the fact that, you know, this is not a Buzz biopic, you know, the whole story does not revolve around Buzz. So my challenge as I saw it was to stay, do justice to the words on the page and tell the story that the writers want to tell. But also get the, you have to do justice to the historical figure, you know, and you have to do, you have to get that part right, at least right enough that when he sees it, he doesn't wrinkle his nose at it and think it's terrible. what that involved for me was just tons of research. I read every book he wrote and published. I watched a bunch of old film of him during that era on YouTube. YouTube's great for that. You know, the best part about playing him was just learning about all the stuff that they had to do. And I really do have a new appreciation for what those guys went through at that time, because they really did put their lives on the line to go fly in that tin can 200 and some odd thousand miles to the moon. It's just crazy what they did. They were not supposed to be successful, and everyone thought they could be, but no one was really sure. So these guys are really, really amazing folks. And so it was a lot of pressure to get it right, you know, just to kind of get an idea of who Buzz was, what he was motivated by at that point in his life, what he felt his responsibilities were, you know, and you just kind of go from there.
Have you met Buzz?
I haven't. You know, he and I exchanged a couple of emails because through some friends on the show, I managed to reach out to him. So no, I never met him. I would love to meet him someday. It would be great.
Imagine like 20 years ago, somebody tells you in 20 years, you'll be playing Buzz Aldrin and you'll be exchanging emails with him.
I know. It's really bizarre. We work in this weird business, man, because anything can happen. Literally, you can wind up being on set shoulder to shoulder with anyone. I remember the first time I felt very weird about being in a room was when I worked with Kevin Costner. And, you know, he was on the set in his chair. Somehow some PA put his chair next to my chair. And so I'm sitting in my chair, literally alone in a small room waiting for my time on set. And in walks, you know, the guy from Dances with Wolves, who I saw when I was 14. And it's just so strange, you know. And I have no explanation for that other than that is one thing that really keeps me going in this business, is that anything can happen and you can have the most amazing, unexpected experiences with little to no warning. And I don't know that you get that in a lot of other careers. So I have fun even when things are slow and I'm wondering, you know, if for some reason my email doesn't work because I'm not getting any auditions. You know, it's kind of like once in a while you just hit one out of the park, and it's a lot of fun to keep going after that next moment.
You mentioned that you were under pressure because you're playing this hero and a historical figure and everything. I'm wondering if there was added pressure because this was one of the few shows that Apple was going to be coming out with. I know that that can happen sometimes. I did a commercial recently for a fast food company, and I'd done a bunch of commercials for them before, and then another ad agency picked them up. And so it was the first commercial for this new ad agency, and was a ton of pressure.
Oh, boy.
I mean, it was a pressure cooker.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So what was your experience like with that?
Yeah, it was. So I think the pressure on our show showed up in the detail of the work. I've never been on a show that spent so much time, money, and effort on getting every single aspect of what we were doing right. The directive from Apple was, whatever you do, get all the NASA stuff 1,000% right. Because they knew that there would be guys out there who know what they're talking about, going through this footage frame by frame and making sure that this gauge was correct and that correct button was pressed and this, you know, this phrase that was said was appropriate for the circumstances that were around at the time. I mean, they found our mission control set was unbelievable. It was literally built down to the inch. So it was correct. The room that's in Houston, you could pick it up and you could drop it into our set and it would be exact. They found some of the consoles in museums and they brought them in. The ones they couldn't find, they built. They found vintage Oreo wrappers from the 60s and wrapped Oreos in them so that, you know, as part of the set dressing. It was, I've never been on anything quite that detailed. And all of the binders on that mission control set, if you're wondering, and you were watching the show, they all literally have official NASA documents inside the binders. Like, there's not blank paper inside. So these console guys, these engineers that go and they reach and they pull things, when they open to a certain page as they're looking things up, they're looking at the actual technical documents. So I think part of that, part of why they went so deep, is because of the fact that this was going to be the you know, one of the first shows that Apple sort of you know, put out on their platform. Apple's putting their stake in the ground. They're maybe a little bit late to the party because so many other, you know, streaming services are out there, and they want to get it right. And I can say that we're all pretty confident that we got a lot of stuff right, and that went for me as well. Like, the suits we were wearing were period correct. They were functional. We couldn't breathe inside of them without the without our ventilation tubes hooked up, just like the real guys. All of the gauges and the buttons and everything in our spacecraft, all, you know, are the toggles are spring loaded so that when you flip one, it actually makes that snappy click sound, as opposed to a lot of times they would just be built and they'd be loose if they were props. So the details there were no details overlooked. And it was an amazing project to see the back end of it and all the work that was put into it. It was really cool.
I believe that if anybody, I'm sure people are going to be interested. You can get a week free. If you sign up for Apple.
Yeah. So I think it's been changing a little bit. So my understanding is that if you're a recent Apple customer, like you just bought an iPhone or an iPad or, you know, something, and you have an Apple ID associated with that new device, then you have a year's worth of Apple TV Plus for free. If you don't, if you haven't bought one in the past, then or recently, then I think you can sign up for like a free trial or something. You get the first three episodes of every show. Our show's, I think, worth the time. I also think you need to give it a little bit of time. I think the first couple, three episodes are really interesting, but I feel like the show actually gets more tense and sort of engrossing as you go through the season. So I hope everybody watches all of them. But I'll do a shout out to the morning show as well, which is really what, you know, that's like the big guns. Apple put the big, huge money behind that show with, you know, Reese Witherspoon and Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston. And let me tell you, if you haven't seen that show, there is some writing and acting on that show that is phenomenal. It deserves whatever awards it's going to get. So, you know, I would definitely put that in the queue as well.
I want to get to some of the listener questions.
Oh, sure.
But I want to ask you, how has your career changed from this booking, from this show coming out?
It hasn't really changed at all.
Okay.
I'm a little bit more visible. I've had a little bit of interest from some you know, smaller blogs and publications and stuff that find the angle of, you know, me playing Buzz Aldrin kind of interesting. So I did some press this time around, which I've never done before. So in that sense, the show and the role I play has increased my visibility a little bit, and that's cool. That has not translated yet into into another job, into my next job. I'm still waiting for the next thing to come along. So I think that there will be an effect long term. I just can't really say what that is right now.
That is the same response that I've gotten from that question basically every time I've asked it. When somebody has gotten a big role on a popular show, I'm always like, how has your career changed? I'm like, it hasn't.
Yeah. It's so weird. I'm sure you read the article. I'm sorry, I don't know the actor's name, but the guy who played Aladdin in Disney's live version of Aladdin, that just can't, that they broadcast like 7 months ago or something like that. He was in Variety or Hollywood Reporter or something talking about how he hasn't had one audition since Aladdin aired. And he played the title role in this huge Disney property. So I think it's very common that, you know, you go, you do something and you think this is going to be the one, this is going to be the thing that puts me on the map. And more often than not, it's just like, yeah, great, you got this job. And the world moves on, you know?
Yeah. Before we move on, any other big takeaways from working on that job?
That job was very team oriented. I mean, all jobs are team oriented, but that one seemed more so because they were the cast was so large and the advising staff was pretty large. Like we are technical advisors, and it was very important to be a really good team player. I think that's easy for sometimes to let go of, to forget that you are part of like a machine and you can't clog the machine. You can't do anything to clog the machine. Your job is to just grease it and make sure it runs as smoothly as possible. And if you do that, it may feel to you that you're just kind of blending in, but that's your job. Until you're leading a series, until you're the guy or girl at the top, number one on the call sheet, your job is to make it easy for everybody else to do their job. And that's how you stand out. Doing For All Mankind was like that on steroids. Like there were so many moving parts that they just needed me to show up and do my stuff and not screw anything up. And so I feel like I did a good job of that, which could have contributed to me being brought back for all those additional episodes.
People are going to kill me if I don't circle back to something that you said earlier, which was that you feel like your audition prep has significantly changed.
All right.
In the years that you've been in LA. And if I don't ask you for specifics, I'm going to get death threats.
We don't want anybody to at you on that. Before moving to LA, I think my audition prep pretty much consisted of I was script focused. So I wanted to make sure that I was, you know, telling the story that was on the page, and I did my script analysis and blah, blah, blah. Well, now that's changed and I do much more research if I have the time. And by that, I mean, I go up and I look up the writers. I look up, if I haven't seen the show, I go and try to see the show. I will look up the director, try to figure out. And the whole thing, all I'm doing is like intelligence gathering. I'm trying to get a couple of details about, you know, what their expectations are, because I really do believe that creatively it's all about what's on the page. But in terms of the casting decision, you also have to, you have to make adjustments based on what the production team's expectations are going to be. Each show has a different style. Each director has a different style. And so if you go in to an audition for 13 Reasons Why, the same way that you're going to go into an audition for CSI, you're doing it wrong. Like you cannot apply the same sort of mentality to both shows because they're very different shows with different acting styles. So it's taken me a while to realize that. And I've been able to tailor my auditions for the project and the people behind the project who are going to be seeing the audition. So it's less about me and what I want to do with the character. Yes, that's important, but it's also paying attention to what has, what's worked for others in the past and what the writer and the director and the network even, respond to positively. So I guess the more detail you can bring, the more you can know about all the players involved, the better. I think the more prepared you are.
So I have some listener questions that came in through the Facebook group, which is just Action, the Pursuit of Acting Excellence. Go join it if you want to ask questions for future guests. So Nicole Rogers Fryer asks, what's great about the Chicago market that you miss?
I miss the community. And I think that's probably because I was part of it for so long. It felt very tight knit to me. A community, I think, is harder to find on the West Coast than it was in Chicago. I think, you know, I found that I'm putting more time and effort into finding those folks that kind of, you know, that speak your language, that you gel with. And, you know, I don't want to say, you know, there are rumors and people say that everybody's out for themselves in LA and nobody cares about you. That's not entirely true. There are communities out here that are supportive. But I think because it is so large and there are so many communities that you can just bounce a little bit from one to the other before you find the one that really clicks. So I miss, you know, Chicago's home, and everybody in the business were friends of mine. So I miss having those folks, to fall back on or rely on or pick their brains or whatever. So yeah, I'd say the community.
She also asks, how do you balance helping your kids with their acting/voiceover careers versus getting out of their way? So I know that I'm really interested in this because I know that you have had at least one of your twins, I'm not sure about both, have been having some success in this.
Yeah.
Industry. What's going on?
Yeah. So we do have twin boys. One of them is not interested in acting or voiceover at all. The other one is. He's a voiceover kid. And he gets the best auditions in the house. It's truly shocking, the amount of work that kids that are available to kids out here. So the big news right now is that he has a small role in Klaus, which is a Netflix movie that came out this Christmas that's been nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Feature. So we're all very excited about that. And, you know, he fell into this because he started doing stuff in Chicago. When I would get an audition that was like, you know, maybe a radio spot, and, you know, there was an announcer, a dad, and a kid, I would just throw him in on the kid part if it made sense for his age. And so his very first job, he was 3 years old because he booked a Hallmark commercial. We moved here, and, you know, I hooked him up with the agency I was with for voiceover, and, you know, I expected that he would audition for commercials, and they kept sending him all this animation stuff, and he was just booking stuff because he's got this cute little voice. And by now that he's been doing it long enough, he understands kind of like how to, you know, develop a character a little bit. And so he's doing well enough. We're happy that he's a voiceover kid and not an on-camera kid because it's much less disruptive to our life. Voiceover, everything happens at home. All the auditions, you know, we can do here. We have a booth in the house. We don't have to leave or take him out of school. A lot of the work, when he does book a job, they'll book him after school. So he's a normal kid. He goes to normal, you know, school down the street. He doesn't have to, you know, be in school on set. And he has a lot of fun with it. So how do I stay out of the way? Basically, I just facilitate the auditions that come his way. So I'll coach him through his auditions. You know, he knows enough to be able to kind of feel his way through most scripts, but sometimes, you know, he comes across something that's unfamiliar, and I'll coach him through that. And then the hardest part about it is actually keeping my mouth shut when he's on the job, because he'll be in the booth and a director will be directing him, and sometimes he won't be really understanding what's being asked of him. And it's hard for me to let go and not be his coach in that moment and let the director do his thing, because it's not my place. So that's the hardest part. but other than that, it's just kind of like sit back and watch and, you know, give him tips here and there and let him know what to expect, because that always helps if he knows what to expect in any particular setting. So yeah, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun having him as part of the business too.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. That's cool. I want to thank everybody who asked questions. Randy, I think we got most of your questions answered. I want to ask one from Julio Cesar Guerrero, and then I have one more after that. We'll wrap up with that. So he asks, when it comes to acting, Chris, have you ever felt convinced that you reached a technical limit in your abilities and then found out that that wasn't the case? And he wants to know, if so, how did you get past that plateau?
Well, I think that I am always learning. When I learn a new thing, I realize that it's connected to another thing that I don't know. So have I reached the technical limits of my ability? Probably many times. I don't really think of it like that. Like I don't struggle with something and realize, oh, I think that's maybe my limit. I just try to learn the next thing that'll get me over the hump. You know, eventually you kind of cobble together a system that works for you pretty consistently.
Chris, I have one more question, but I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You and I go way back. We've known each other for a long time. So to come back and have a chat with a real pro, I appreciate that a lot. So thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. I appreciate you. If you enjoyed this episode, do us both a favor and take a screenshot of your phone or wherever you're playing this episode and put it on Instagram and tag Chris, which is at Chris Agos, A-G-O-S, and me, Lee Foster 123. And that's L-E-I-G-H. And just say that you're listening. Say what's up. So last question from Loriana Israelova, I believe is how you say it. She wants you to share your top secret for booking a job in any medium, TV, VO, commercials. That's a big one.
That is a big one. Be what they're looking for. Because really, that's who gets the work. It's weird, you know, they have this idea when they send out an audition, whoever they is, whether that's the writer, a director, a copywriter, you know, casting director, they have this vision, this thing in their head that they're hearing or seeing. And the people who match up with that vision, those are the people that get called back and get shortlisted. It really is, it is interesting that, you know, you could bring 5, 10, 20 people into the room and have them read the same sides or put them on mic and have them read the same script. And each of them brings something different to it, but there's always going to be a handful of people that kind of line up with what you thought you were going to get. And if you're on that list, then you get the job. You're closer to getting the job. So I don't really think that there is a secret. I think it has to do with your prep, your confidence level. But at the end of the day, the decision makers have an idea of what they're looking for, and you don't know what that is. It's part of the frustrating thing about this business. You don't know what that is.
If you like this podcast, please go to your podcast app, scroll down, and give me a rating or a review. Thank you for listening.